13. You amid relics. It begins to feel as though you've lived in Kostrima all your life. It shouldn't. Just another calm, just another name, just another new start, or at least a partial one. It will probably end the way all the others have, but it makes a difference that here everyone knows what you are. That is the one good thing about the Fulcrum, about Mayov, about being Cyanide. You could be who you were. That's a luxury you're learning to savor anew. You're topside again in Kostrima Over, as they've been calling it, standing on what used to be the town's token Greenland. The ground around Kostrima is alkaline and sandy. You heard Yika actually hoping for a little acid rain to make the soil better. You think the ground probably needs more organic matter for that to work. And there isn't likely to be much of that, since you saw 3 boil bug mounds on the way here. The good news is that the mounds are easy to detect, even when they're only a little higher than the ash layer that covers the ground. The insects within them tickle your awareness as a ready source of heat and pressure for your orogeny. On the walk here, you showed the children how to assess for that pent difference from the cooler, more relaxed ambient around it. The younger ones made a game of it, gasping and pointing whenever they sensed a mound and trying to outdo one another in the count. The bad news is that there are more of the boilbug mounds this week than there were last week. That's probably not a good thing, but you don't let the children see your worry. There are 17 children altogether, the bulk of Kostrima's complement of origins. A couple are in the teen range, but most are younger, one only 5. Most are orphans, or might as well be, and that does not surprise you at all. What does surprise you is that all of them must have relatively good self-control and quick wits, because otherwise they wouldn't have survived the rifting. They would have had to assess it coming, in time enough to get to someplace isolated, let their instinct save them, recover, and then go someplace else before anybody started trying to figure out who was at the center of the circle of non-destruction. Most are mid-ladder mongrels like you. Lots of not-quite-sunsed bronze skin, not-quite-ash-blow hair, eyes and bodies on a continuum from the Arctic to the coaster. Not much different from the kids you used to teach in Turimo's creche. Only the subject matter, and by necessity, your teaching methods must be different. Sess what I do. Just sess. Don't imitate yet, you say. And then you construct a torus around yourself. You do it several times, each time a different way. Sometimes spinning it high and tight, sometimes holding it steady, but wide enough that its edge rolls close to them. Half the children gasp and scramble away. That's exactly what they should do. Good. Not good that the rest just stood there stupidly. You'll have to work on that. Now, spread out. You there, you there. All of you, stay about that far apart. Once you're in place, spin a torus that looks exactly like the one I'm making now. It isn't how the Fulcrum would have taught them. There, with years of time and safe walls and comforting blue skies overhead, the teaching could be done gently, gradually, giving the children time to get over their fears or outgrow their immaturities. There's no time for gentleness in a season, though, and no room for failure within Kostrima's jagged walls. You've heard the grumbling, seen the resentful looks when you join use-cast crews or head down to the communal bath. Yika thinks Kostrima is something special, a calm where Raga and Still can live in harmony, working together to survive. You think she's naive. These children need to be prepared for the inevitable day that Kostrima turns on them. So you demonstrate, and correct their imitations with words when you can, and once with a torus inversion slap when one of the older children spins his too wide and threatens to ice one of his comrades. You cannot be careless. The boy sits on the icy ground, staring at you wide-eyed. You also made the ground heave under his feet to throw him down, and you're standing over him now, shouting, deliberately intimidating. He almost killed another child. He should be afraid.
People die when you make mistakes. Is that what you want?
A frantic headshake.
Then get up and do it again.
You flog them through the exercise until every one of them has demonstrated at least a basic ability to control the size of their torus. It feels wrong to teach them only this without any of the theory that will help them understand why and how their power works, or any of the stabilizing exercises designed to perfect the detachment of instinct from power. You must teach them in days what you mastered over years. Where you are an artist, they will be only crude imitators at best. They are subdued when you walk them back to Kostrima, and you suspect some of them hate you. Actually, you're pretty sure they hate you. But they will be more useful to Kostrima like this, and on the inevitable day that Kostrima turns on them, they'll be ready. This is a familiar series of thoughts. Once, as you trained Nossun, you told yourself that it did not matter if she hated you by the end of it. She would know your love by her own survival. That never felt right, though, did it? You were gentler with Uche for that reason, and you always meant to apologize to Nossun later when she was old enough to understand. Ah, there are so many regrets in you that they spin, heavy as compressed iron at your core.
You're right,
Alabaster says as you sit on an infirmary cot and tell him about the lesson later.
But you're also wrong.
It's later than usual for you to be visiting Alabaster, and as a result, he is restless and in visible pain amid his nest. The medications that Lerna usually gives him are wearing off. Being with him is always a competition of desires for you. You know there's not much time for him to teach you this stuff, but you also want to prolong his life, and every day that you wear him down grates on you like a glacier. Urgency and despair don't get along well. You've resolved to keep it brief this time, but he seems inclined to talk a lot today as he leans against Antimony's hand and keeps his eyes closed. You can't help thinking of this as some kind of strength-saving gesture, as if just the sight of you is a drain. Wrong, you prompt. Maybe there's a warning note in your voice. You've always been protective of your students, whoever they are.
For wasting your time, for one thing. They'll never have the precision to be more than rock pushers.
Alabaster's voice is thick with contempt. Inan was a rock pusher, you snap. A muscle flexes in his jaw, and he pauses for a moment.
So maybe it's a good thing that you're teaching them how to push rocks safely, even if you aren't doing it kindly.
Now the contempt is gone from his words. It's as close to an apology as you're probably going to get from him.
But I stand by the rest. You're wrong to teach them at all, because their lessons are getting in the way of your lessons.
What? He makes you cess one of his stumps again, and oh. Suddenly, it's harder to grasp the stuff between his cells. It takes longer for your perception to adjust, and when it does, you keep having to reflexively jerk yourself out of a tendency to notice only the heat and jittering movement of the small particles. One afternoon of teaching has set your learning back by a week or more.
There's a reason the fulcrum taught you the way it did,
he explains finally, when you sit back and rub your eyes and fight down frustration. He's opened his eyes now. They are hooded as they watch you.
The fulcrum's methods are a kind of conditioning meant to steer you toward energy redistribution and away from magic. The torus isn't even necessary. You can gather ambient energy in any number of ways. But that's how they teach you to direct your awareness down to perform orogeny, never up. Nothing above you matters, only your immediate surroundings, never farther.
He shakes his head to the degree that he can.
It's amazing when you think about it. Everyone in the stillness is like this. Never mind what's in the oceans. Never mind what's in the sky. Never look at your horizon and wonder what's beyond it. We've spent centuries making fun of the astronomists for their crackpot theories. But what we really found incredible was that they ever bothered to look up to formulate them.
You'd almost forgotten this part of him. The dreamer, the rebel, always reconsidering the way things have always been, because maybe they should never have been that way in the first place. He's right, too. Life in the stillness discourages reconsideration, reorientation. Wisdom is set in stone, after all. That's why no one trusts the mutability of metal. There's a reason alabaster was the magnetic core of your little family back when you were together. Damn, you're nostalgic today. It prompts you to say, I think you're not just a ten-ringer. He blinks in surprise. You're always thinking. You're a genius, too. It's just that your genius is in a subject area that no one respects. Alabaster stares at you for a moment, his eyes narrow.
Are you drunk?
No, I'm not. Evil Earth, so much for your fond memories. Go on with the rusting lesson. He seems more relieved by the change of subject than you.
So that's what fulcrum training does to you. You learn to think of orogeny as a matter of effort, when it's really perspective and perception.
An Alia-shaped trauma tells you why the fulcrum wouldn't have wanted every two-shard ferrule reaching for any obelisks nearby. But you spend a moment trying to understand the distinction he's explaining. It's true that using energy is something entirely different from using magic. The fulcrum's method makes Orogeny feel like what it is, straining to shove around heavy objects, just with will instead of hands or levers. Magic, though, feels effortless, at least while one is using it. The exhaustion comes later. In the moment, though, it is simply about knowing it's there, training yourself to see it. I don't understand why they did this, you say, tapping your fingers on the mattress in thought. The fulcrum was built by Orogens. At least some of them, at some point in the past, must have sensed magic. But you shiver as you understand.
Oh, yes.
The most powerful Orogens, the ones who detect magic most easily and perhaps have trouble mastering energy redistribution as a result, are the ones who end up in the nodes. Alabaster thinks in bigger pictures than just the fulcrum.
I think, he says, they understood the danger. Not just that Raugas, who lacked the necessary fine control, would connect to the obelisks and die, but that some might do it successfully for the wrong reasons.
You try to think of a right reason to activate a network of ancient death machines. Alabaster reads your face.
I doubt I'm the first Raga who's wanted to tip the fulcrum into a lava pit.
Good point.
And the war. Don't ever forget that. The guardians who work with the fulcrum are one of the factions I told you about, so to speak. They're the ones who want the status quo. Ragas made safe and useful, stills doing all the work, and thinking they run the place. Guardians actually in charge of everything. Controlling the people who can control natural disasters.
You're surprised by this. No, you're surprised you didn't think of it yourself. But then you haven't spent much time thinking about guardians when you weren't in the immediate vicinity of one. Maybe this is another kind of thought aversion you've been conditioned to. Don't look up, and don't think about those damned smiles.
You decide to make yourself think about them now.
But guardians die during a season.
Shit.
They say they die.
Shit.
Of course they don't. Alabaster lets out a rusty sound that might be a laugh.
I'm a bad influence.
He always has been. You can't help smiling, though the feeling doesn't last because of the conversation.
They don't join comms, though.
They must go somewhere else to ride it out.
Maybe. Maybe this warrant place. No one seems to know where it is.
He pauses, grows thoughtful.
I suppose I should have asked mine about that before I left her.
No one just leaves their guardian.
You said you didn't kill her.
He blinks out of memory.
No, I cured her. Sort of.
You know about the thing in their heads.
Yes. Blood and the sting of your palm. Shafa handing something tiny and bloody to another guardian with great care.
You nod.
It gives them their abilities, but it also taints them, twists them. The seniors at the Fulcrum used to speak of it in whispers. There are degrees of contamination.
He sets his jaw, visibly steering himself away from that topic. You can guess why. Somewhere along the way, it lands on the shirtless guardians who kill with a touch.
Anyway, I took that thing out of mine.
You swallow. I saw a guardian kill another once, taking it out.
Yes, when the contamination becomes too great. Then they're dangerous even to other guardians and must be purged. I'd heard they weren't gentle about it, brutes even to their own.
It's angry, Guardian Time had said right before Shafa killed her, readying for the time of return. You inhale. The memory is vivid in your mind because that was the day that you and Tonki, Beanoff, found the socket. The day of your first ring test, early, and with your life in the balance. You'll never forget anything of that day, and now. It's the Earth.
What?
The thing that's in Guardians. The contaminant. It changed those who would control it. Chained them fate to fate. She started speaking for the Earth.
You can tell you've actually surprised him, for once.
Then,
he considers for a moment.
I see. That's when they switch teams. Stop working for the status quo and guardian interests, and start working for the Earth's interests instead. No wonder the others kill them.
This is what you need to understand. What does the Earth want? Alabaster's gaze is heavy, heavy.
What does any living thing want, facing an enemy so cruel that it stole away a child?
Your jaw tightens. Vengeance. You shift down from the cot to the floor, leaning against the cot's frame. Tell me about the obelisk gate.
Yes, I thought that would get you interested.
Alabaster's voice has gone soft again, but there is a look on his face that makes you think this is what he looked like on the day he made the rift.
You remember the basic principle, parallel scaling. Yoking two oxen together instead of one. Two ragas together can do more than each individually. It works for obelisks, too, just exponential. A matrix, not a yoke. Dynamic.
Okay, you're following so far. So, I need to figure out how to chain all of them together. He nods back minutely.
And you'll need a buffer, at least initially. When I opened the gate at Humanus, I used several dozen node maintainers.
Several dozen stunted, twisted ragas turned into mindless weapons, and Alabaster somehow turned them against their owners. How like him, and how perfect. Buffer?
To cushion the impact, to smooth out the connection flow.
He falters, sighs.
I don't know how to explain it. You'll know when you try it.
When? He assumes so much. What you did? Killed the node maintainers?
Not precisely. I used them to open the gate and create the rift. And then they tried to do what they were made to do. Stop the shake. Stabilize the land.
You grimace, understanding. Even you in your extremity weren't foolish enough to try to stop the shockwave when it reached Terimo. The only safe thing to do was divert its force elsewhere. But node maintainers lack the mind or control to do the safe thing.
I didn't use all of them,
Alabaster says thoughtfully.
The ones far to the west and in the Arctics and Antarctics were out of my reach. Most have died since. No one to keep them alive. But I can still assess active nodes in a few places. Remnants of the network. South, near the Antarctic fulcrum, and north, near Renanis.
Of course he can assess active nodes all the way in the Antarctics. You can barely assess 100 miles from Kastrema, and you have to work to stretch that far. And maybe the Ragas of the Antarctic fulcrum have survived somehow, and chosen to care for their less fortunate brethren in the nodes, but...
Renanis? That can't be. It's an equatorial city.
More southerly and westerly than most. People in Eumenes thought it was only a step above any other Somidlat's backwater. But Renanis was equatorial enough that it should be gone.
The rift wends northwesterly, along an ancient fault line that I found. It swung a few 100 miles wide of Renanis. I suppose that was enough to let the node maintainers actually do something. Should have killed most of them. And the rest should have died of neglect when their staffs abandoned them, but I don't know.
He falls silent, perhaps weary. His voice is hoarse today, and his eyes are bloodshot. Another infection. He keeps getting them because some of the burned patches on his body aren't healing, Lerna says. The lack of pain meds isn't helping. You try to digest what he's told you, what Antimony has told you, what you've learned through trial and suffering. Maybe the numbers matter. 216 obelisks, some incalculable number of other origins as a buffer, and you. Magic to tie the three together, somehow. All of it together forging a net to catch the Earthfire's damned moon. Alabaster says nothing while you ponder, and eventually you glance at him to see if he's fallen asleep. But he's awake, his eyes slits, watching you. What? You frown, defensive as always. He quarter-smiles with the half of his mouth that hasn't been burned.
You never change. If I ask you for help, you tell me to flake off and die. If I don't say a rusting word, you work miracles for me.
He sighs.
Evil Earth, how I've missed you.
This hurts unexpectedly. You realize why at once, because it's been so long since anyone said anything like this to you. Jija could be affectionate, but he wasn't much given to sentimentality. Inan used sex and jokes to show his tenderness. But Alabaster, this has always been his way. The surprise gesture, the backhanded compliment that you could choose to take for teasing or an insult. You've hardened so much without this, without him. You seem strong, healthy, but inside you feel like he looks. Nothing but brittle stone and scars, prone to cracking if you bend too much. You try to smile and fail. He doesn't try. You just look at each other. It's nothing and everything at once. Of course it doesn't last. Someone walks into the infirmary and comes over and surprises you by being Yika. Yarka's behind her, slouching along and looking very sensedly bored. Picking her sharp-filed teeth with a bit of polished wood, one hand on her well-curved hip, her ash-blow hair a worse mess than usual, and noticeably flatter on one side where she's just woken up.
"Sorry to interrupt,"
Yika says, not sounding especially sorry.
"But we've got a problem."
You're beginning to hate those words. Still, it's time to end the lesson, so you nod to Alabaster and get up.
What now? Your friend, this slacker.
Tonki, who hasn't joined the innovator's work crews, doesn't bother to pick up your household share when it's her turn, and who conveniently disappears whenever it's time for a cast meeting. In another com, they'd have already kicked her out for that kind of thing. But she gets extra leeway for being one of the companions of the second most powerful origin in Kastrima. It only goes so far, though, and Yika looks especially pissed off.
"She's found the control room," Yika says. "Locked herself inside."
"The... what? The control room for what?"
"Kastrima!"
Yika looks annoyed to have to explain.
"I told you when you got here. There are mechanisms that make this place function. The light and the air and so on. We keep the room secret because if somebody loses it and wants to smash things, they could kill us all. But your mess is in there doing evil earth knows what, and I'm basically asking you if it's okay to kill her, because that's about where I am right now."
"She won't be able to affect anything important," Alabaster says. It startles you both. You, because you aren't used to seeing him interact with anyone else, and Yika, because she probably thinks of him as a waste of medicines and not a person. He doesn't think much of her either. His eyes are closed again.
"More likely to hurt herself than anything else."
"Good to know," Yika says, though she looks at him skeptically.
"I'd be reassured if you weren't talking out of your ass, seeing as you couldn't possibly know what's happening beyond this infirmary, but it's a nice thought, anyway."
He lets out a soft snort of amusement.
"I knew everything I needed to know about this relic the instant I came here. And if any of you other than Esun had a chance of making it do what it's really capable of, I wouldn't stay here a moment longer."
As you and Yika stare, he lets out a heavy sigh. There's a little bit of a rattle in it which troubles you, and you make a note to ask Lerna about it. But he says nothing more, and finally, Yika glances at you with a palpable "I am really sick of your friends" look, and beckons for you to follow her out. It's a long way up to wherever this control room is. Kyarka's breathing hard after the first ladder, but she acclimates after that and settles into a rhythm. Yika does better, though she's still sweating in 10 minutes. You've still got your road conditioning, so you handle the climb well enough. But after the first 3 flights of stairs, a ladder, and a spiraling balcony built round one of the fatter crystals of the calm, you're even willing to start small talk to take your mind off the ground falling farther and farther below. "What's your usual disciplinary process for people who shirk their cast duties?"
"The boot. What else?" Yika shrugs. "We can't just ash them out, though. Have to kill them to maintain secrecy. But there's a process. One warning, then a hearing. Morat, that's the innovator cast spokeswoman, hasn't made a formal complaint. I asked her to, but she waffled. Said your friend gave her a portable water testing device that may save some of our hunters' lives out in the field."
Yarka utters a rusty laugh. You shake your head, amused. That's a nice bribe. She is a survivor, if nothing else. Yika rolls her eyes.
"Maybe, but it sends a bad message. One person not joining any work crews and going unpunished for it, even if she does invent useful things outside of work time. Others start to skive off. What do I do then?"
"Ash out the ones who haven't invented anything," you suggest. Then you stop because Yika has paused. You think it's because she's annoyed by what you just said. But she's looking around, taking in the expanse of the calm, so you stop too. This far up, you're well above the main inhabited level of the calm. The geode echoes with calls, and someone hammering something, and one of the work crews singing a rhythm song. You risk a look over the nearest railing and see that someone's made a simple rope and wooden pallet cargo lift for the mid-level, but without a counterweight. The only way to get a heavy load up is to basically play tug-of-war with it. 20 people are at it now. It looks surprisingly like fun.
"You were right about the simulations," Hjarka says.
Her voice is soft as she, too, contemplates the bustle and life of Kostrima.
We couldn't have made this place work without more people. Thought you were full of shit, but you weren't.
Ika sighs.
So far, it's working.
She eyes Hjarka.
You never said you didn't like the idea before.
Hjarka shrugs.
I left my home calm because I didn't want the burden of leadership. Didn't want it here either. You don't have to knife fight me for the headwomanship to give an opinion for Earth's sake.
When a season's coming on, and I'm the only leader in the comm, I'd better be careful even about opinions. She shrugs, then smiles at Yika with an air of something like affection.
Keep figuring you'll have me killed any minute now.
Yika laughs once.
Is that what you would have done in my place?
You hear the edge in this.
It's the playbook I was taught to follow, yeah. But it'd be stupid to try that here. There's never been anything like this season, or this comm.
Hjarka eyes you pointedly as the latest example of Kostrima's peculiarity.
Tradition's just going to rust everything up in a situation like this. Better to have a headwoman who doesn't know how things should be, only how she wants them to be. A headwoman who'll kick all the asses necessary to make her vision happen.
Yika absorbs this in silence for a few moments. Obviously, whatever Tonki's done isn't so urgent or terrible. Then she turns and begins climbing again, apparently deciding that the rest break is over. You and Hjarka sigh and follow.
I think the people who originally built this place didn't think it through.
Yika says as the climb resumes.
Too inefficient. Too dependent on machinery that can break down or rust out. And orogeny as a power source, which is basically the least reliable thing ever. But then, sometimes I wonder if maybe they didn't intend to build it this way. Maybe something drove them underground fast, and they found a giant geode and just made the best of what they had.
She runs a hand along a railing as you walk. This is one of the original metal structures that have been built throughout the geode. Above the inhabited levels, it's all old metalwork.
Always makes me think they really must have been the ancestors of Kostrima. They respected hard work and adapting under pressure, like us.
Doesn't everyone?
Except Tonki.
Some? She doesn't take the obvious bait.
I outed myself to everyone when I was 15. There was a forest fire somewhere to the south, drought season. The smoke alone was killing the older people and babies in the comm. We thought we'd have to leave. Finally, I went to the edge of the fire, where a bunch of the other townsfolk were trying to create a firebreak. 6 of them died doing that.
She shakes her head.
Wouldn't have worked. The fire was too big. But that's my people for you.
You nod.
It does sound like the Kostrimans you've gotten to know.
It also sounds like the Tarimo folk you've gotten to know, and the Maovites, and the Alians, and the Humanescens. No people in the stillness would have survived to this point if they weren't fearsomely tenacious. But Yika needs to think of Kostrima as special. And it is special, in its own strange ways. So you wisely keep your mouth shut.
She says, I stopped the fire, iced the burning part of the forest, and used that to make a ridge farther south as a windbreak in case anything set off a new blaze. Everyone saw me do it. They knew exactly what I was then.
You stop walking and stare at her. She turns back, half smiling.
I told them I'd go if they wanted to call the guardians and have me shipped off to the fulcrum, or if they wanted to just string me up. I promised not to ice anyone. Instead, they argued about the whole mess for 3 days. I thought they were trying to decide how to kill me.
She shrugs.
So I went home, had dinner with my parents. They both knew, and they were terrified for me. But I talked them down from smuggling me out of town in a horse cart. Went to crash the next day, same as always. At the end of it, I found out the townsfolk had been arguing about how to get me trained. Without letting the fulcrum on, see? Your mouth falls open. You've seen Yika's parents, who are still hale and strong and with an air of sansed stubbornness about them. You can believe it of them. But everyone else, too? All right, maybe Kastrima is special. Hjarka says, huh, how did you get trained then?
Eh, you know what these little Midlatter comms are like. They were still arguing about it when the rifting happened. I trained my damn self.
She laughs, and Hjarka sighs.
That's my people, too. Complete rust heads, but good people.
You think against your will. If only I had brought Uche and Nasun here as soon as they were born. Not all of your people like having us here, you blurt, almost as a rebuttal to your own thought.
Yeah, I've heard the chatter, which is why I'm glad you're training the kids, and that everyone saw you get the boil bugs off Tatis.
She sobers.
Poor Tatis. But you proved again that it's better to have people like us around than to kill us or drive us out. Kastrimans are practical people, Essie.
You hate this nickname immediately.
Too practical to just do something because everyone else says do it.
With that, she resumes the climb. After a moment, you and Hjarka do too. You've gotten used to the unrelenting whiteness of Kastrima. Only a few of the building crystals have touches of amethyst or smoky quartz about them. Here, though, the ceiling of the geode has been sealed off with a smooth glass-like substance that is deep emeraldine green in color. The color is a bit of a shock. The final stairway that leads up into this is wide enough for 5 people to climb abreast, so you're unsurprised to find 2 of Kastrima's strongbacks flanking what looks like a sliding attic door made of the same green substance. One of the strongbacks has a small wire-glass utility knife in her hand. The other just has his big folded arms.
"Still nothing," says the male strongback as the 3 of you arrive. "We keep hearing sounds from inside, clicking, buzzing, and sometimes she yells things. But the door's still jammed."
"Yells things?" asks Hjarka. He shrugs.
"Like, I knew it, and that's why."
"Sounds like, Tonki." "How does she have the door rigged?" you ask. The female strongback shrugs. It's a stereotype that strongbacks are all muscle and no brain, but a few of them fit that description more than they should. Yika gives you another, "This is your fault" look. You shake your head, then climb up to the top step and bang on the door.
"Tonki, rust it! Open up!"
There's a moment of silence, and then you hear a faint clatter.
"Fuck, it's you,"
Tonki mutters from somewhere farther away than the door.
"Hang on and don't ice anything."
A moment later, there's the sound of something rattling against the door material. Then the door slides open. You, Yika, Hjarka, and the strongbacks climb up, though all of you except Yika stop and stare. So it's left to her to fold her arms and give Tonki the exasperated glare she's earned. The ceiling is hollow above the door. The green substance forms a floor, and the resulting chamber is molded around the usual white crystals that jut down from the geode's rocky, grayish-green true ceiling, perhaps 15 feet overhead. What makes you stop, your mouth falling open and your mind stuttering from annoyance into silence, is that the crystals on this side of the green barrier flicker and blink, transitioning at random from shimmering images of crystals into solidity and back again. The shafts and tips of these crystals which poke through the floor weren't doing this outside. None of the other crystals in Kastrima do this. Aside from glowing, which granted is a warning that they aren't just rocks, the crystals of Kastrima are no different from any other quartz. Here, though, you suddenly understand what Alabaster meant about what Kastrima is capable of. The truth of Kastrima is suddenly, terrifyingly clear.
the geode is filled with not crystals, but potential obelisks.
Flaking rust, one of the strongbacks breathes.
This speaks for you as well.
Tonki's junk is everywhere in the room. Weird tools and slates and scrapes of leather covered in diagrams and a pallet in the corner that explains why she hasn't been sleeping in the apartment much lately. It's been lonely without her and Hoa, but you don't like admitting this to yourself.
She's walking away from you now, glaring over her shoulder and looking distinctly irritated that you've arrived.
Don't Rusting touch anything, she says. No telling what an origin of your caliber will do to this stuff.
Yika rolls her eyes.
You're the one who shouldn't be touching anything. You're not allowed in here, and you know it. Come on. No.
Tonki crouches near a strange low plinth at the center of the room. It looks like a crystal shaft whose middle has been chopped out. You see the flickering, unreal base growing from the ceiling, and the plinth is its, flickering in tandem, continuation. But there's a 5-foot section in between that's just empty space. The plinth's surface has been cut out so smoothly that it gleams like a mirror, and the surface stays solid, even as the rest of the shaft flickers. At first, you think there's nothing on it. But Tonki is peering at the plinth's surface so intently that you walk over to join her. When you hunker down for a better look, she glances up to meet your eyes, and you're shocked at the barely disguised glee in hers. Not really shocked by that. You know her by now. You're shocked because this high gleam, plus the new undisguise of her clean short hair and neat clothing, transform her so obviously into an older version of Beanoff that you marvel again that you didn't see it at once. But that's unimportant. You focus on the plinth, even though there are other wonders to behold. A taller plinth near the back of the room, above which floats a foot-tall miniature obelisk the same emerald color as the floor. Another plinth bearing an oblong hunk of rock, also floating. A series of clear squares set into one wall bearing strange diagrams of some sort of equipment. A series of panels along the wall beneath them, each bearing meters, measuring something unknown in numbers that you can't decipher. On the big plinth, though, are the least obtrusive objects in the room, 6 tiny metallic shards, each needle thin and no longer than your thumbnail. They are not the same silvery metal that makes up Kastrima's ancient structures. This metal is a smooth dark color, dusted faintly with red. Iron. Amazing that it hasn't oxidized away over the years of Kastrima's existence. Unless, did you put these here? You ask Tonki. She's instantly furious.
Yes, of course I would enter the control core of a dead civ artifact, find the most dangerous device in it, and immediately throw bits of rusty metal on it.
Don't be an ass, please. Though you did sort of deserve that, you're too intrigued to be really annoyed. Why do you think this is the most dangerous device in here?
Tonki points to the beveled edge of the plinth. You look closer and blink. The material is not smooth like the rest of the crystal shaft. On the edge, it has been heavily etched with symbols and writing. The writing is the same as that along the wall panels.
Oh.
And they are glowing red, the color seeming to float and waver just over the surface of the material.
And this, Tonki says.
She raises a hand and moves it toward the plinth surface and the metal bits. Abruptly, the red letters leap into the air. You don't have a better way to describe what's happening than that. In an instant, they have enlarged and turned to face you, blazing the air at eye level with what is unmistakably some sort of warning. Red is the color of lava pools. It is the color of a lake when everything in it has died except toxic algae. One warning sign of an impending blow. Some things do not change with time or culture, you feel certain.
You are wrong, generally speaking. But in this specific case, you're quite right. everyone staring. Hjarka comes close and lifts a hand to try to touch the floating letters. Her fingers pass through them. Ika moves around the plinth, fascinated despite herself.
I've noticed this thing before, but never really paid attention to it. The letters turn with me.
They haven't moved. But you lean to one side, and sure enough, as you do this, the letters pivot slightly to remain facing you. Impatiently, Tonki pulls her hand back and waves Hjarka's hand out of the way, and the letters flatten and shrink back into quiescence along the plinth edge.
There's no barrier, though. Usually, in a Dead Civ artifact, an artifact from this civilization, anything truly dangerous is sealed off in some way. There's either a physical barrier, or evidence that there was once a barrier that's failed with time. If they really didn't want you to touch something, you either didn't touch it, or you'd have to work pretty damned hard to touch it. This? Just a warning. I don't know what that means.
Can you actually touch those things? You reach toward one of the bits of iron, ignoring the warning this time when it springs up.
Tonki hisses at you so sharply that you jerk back like a child caught doing something you weren't supposed to.
I said don't rusting touch! What's wrong with you?
You clench your jaw, but you deserve that too, and you're too much a mother to deny it.
How long have you been coming in here?
Yika's crouched next to Tonki's sleeping pallet. Tonki's staring down at the iron bits, and at first you think she hasn't heard Yika. She doesn't answer for a long moment. There is a look on her face that you're starting not to like. You can't say you really know her any more now than you did when you were a grit, but you do know that she isn't the grim sort. That she is grim now, the tightened muscle along her jawline, making it stand out more than you know she likes, is a very bad sign. She's up to something. She says to Yika,
a week. But I only moved in 3 days ago, I think. I lost track.
She rubs her eyes.
I haven't slept a lot.
Yika shakes her head and rises.
Well, at least you haven't destroyed the rusting comm already. Tell me what you figured out, then.
Tonki turns to eye her warily.
Those panels along the wall activate and regulate the water pumps and air circulation systems and cooling processes, but you knew that already. Yes, since we are not dead.
Yika dusts off her hands from where she touched the floor, sidling toward Tonki in a way that is somehow simultaneously thoughtful and subtly menacing. She's not as big as most Sansid women, a good foot shorter than Hjarka. Her dangerousness is not as obvious as it is with others, but you sense the slow readying of her orogeny now. She was fully prepared to smash or ice her way into this place. The strong backs shift and edge a little closer too, reinforcing her unspoken threat.
What I want to know, she continues, is how you knew that.
She stops, facing Tonki.
We figured it out in those early days, through trial and error. Touch one thing and it gets cooler, touch another and the communal pool water gets hotter. But nothing's changed in the past week.
Tonki sighs a little.
I've learned how to decipher some of the symbols over the years. Spend enough time in these kinds of ruins and you see the same things repeated over and over.
Yika considers this, then nods toward the warning text around the plinth rim.
What's that say? No idea. I said decipher, not read. Symbols, not language.
Tonki walks over to one of the wall panels and points to a prominent design in its top right corner. It's nothing intuitive. Something green and arrow-like, but squiggly, sort of, pointed downward.
I see that one, wherever there were water gardens. I think it's about the quality and intensity of the light that the gardens get.
She eyes Yika.
Actually, I know it's about the light the gardens get.
Yika lifts her chin a little, just enough that you know Tonki has guessed right.
So this place is no different from other ruins you've seen? The others had crystals in them, like this?
No, I've never seen anything like Kostrema before, except...
She glances at you once and away.
Well, not exactly like Kostrema.
That thing in the fulcrum wasn't anything like this, you blurt. It's been more than 20 years, but you haven't forgotten a detail about the place. That was a pit, and Kostrema is a rock with a hole in it. If both were made by the same kinds of people to do similar things, there's no evidence of that anywhere.
It was, actually.
Tonki comes back to the plinth and waves up the warning. This time, she points at a symbol within the glowing red text, a solid black circle surrounded by a white octagon. You don't know how you missed it before. It stands out from the red.
I saw that mark in the fulcrum, painted onto some of the light panels. You were too busy staring into the pit. I don't think you saw. But I've been in maybe half a dozen obelisk builder sites since, and that mark is always near something dangerous.
She's watching you intently.
I find dead people near it sometimes.
Inadvertently, you think of Guardian Time. Not found dead, but dead nevertheless, and you almost joined her that day. Then you remember a moment in the room without doors, near the edge of the yawning pit. You remember small, needle-like protrusions from the walls of the pit, exactly like these bits of iron. The socket, you murmur. That was what the Guardian called it. A contaminant. A prickle dances across the nape of your neck. Tonki looks sharply at you.
Something dangerous can mean any rusting thing, says Hjarka, annoyed, as you stand there staring at the bits of rust.
No, in this case, it means a specific rusting thing.
Tonki glares Hjarka down, which is impressive in itself.
It was the mark of their enemy.
Fuck, you realize. Fuck, fuck, fuck.
What?
Asks Yika.
What in the evil earth are you talking about?
Their enemy.
Tonki leans against the edge of the plinth, carefully, you note, but emphatically.
They were at war, don't you understand?
Toward the end, just before their civilization vanished into the dust, all their ruins, anything that's left from that time, are defensive, survival-oriented. Like the Calms of today, except they had a lot more than stone walls to help protect them. Things like giant rusting underground geodes. They hid in those places and studied their enemy and maybe built weapons to fight back. She pivots and points up at the upper half of the plinth crystal. It flickers just as she does so, obelisk-like.
No,
you say automatically. Everyone turns to look at you and you twitch.
I mean,
shit, but you've said it now. The obelisks aren't... You don't know how to say it without telling the whole damned story, and you're reluctant to do that. You're not sure why. Maybe for the same reason that Antimony said when Alabaster started to tell you. They aren't ready. Now you need to finish in a way that won't invite further comment. I don't think they're defensive or any sort of weapon. Tonki says nothing for a long moment.
What are they, then?
I don't know.
It's not a lie. You don't know for sure.
A tool, maybe. Dangerous if misused, but not meant to kill. Tonki seems to brace herself.
I know what happened to Alia, Essen.
It's an unexpected blow, and it floors you emotionally. Fortunately, you've spent your life training to deflect your reactions to unexpected blows in safe ways, you say. Obelisks aren't made to do that. That was an accident.
How do you... Because I was connected to the rusting thing when it went into burn down.
You snap this so sharply that your voice echoes in the room and startles you into realizing how angry you are. One of the strongbacks inhales, and something in her gaze shifts, and all at once you are reminded of the strongbacks at Terimo, who looked at you the same way, when Rask asked them to let you go through the gate. Even Yika is watching you, in a way that wordlessly says, you're scaring the locals, calm the rust down. So you take a deep breath and fall silent. It is only later that you will recall the word you said during this conversation, burn down. You will wonder why you said it, what it means, and you will have no answer. Tonki lets out a deep breath carefully, and this seems to speak for the room.
It's possible. I've made some wrong assumptions, she says.
Yika rubs a hand over her hair. It makes her head look incongruously small for a moment until it floofs back up.
All right. We already know Kastrima was used as a comb before, probably several times. If you'd asked me, instead of coming in here and acting like a rusting child, I could have told you that. I would have told you everything I knew, because I want to understand this place just as much as you do.
Tonki utters a single braying laugh.
Huh. None of you are smart enough for that. But by pulling this shit, you've made me mistrust you. I don't let people I don't trust do things that can hurt the people I love. So I want you out of here for good.
Yarka frowns.
Eek, that's kind of harsh, isn't it?
Tonki tenses at once, her eyes going wide with horror and hurt.
You can't keep me out. Nobody else in this rusting calm has a clue what... Nobody else in this rusting calm, Yika says.
And now the strong backs look at her uneasily, because she's nearly shouting.
Would set us all on fire for the chance to study people who've been gone since the world was young. Somehow, I'm getting the impression that you would. Supervised visit,
Tonki blurts. She looks desperate now. Yika steps up to her, getting right in her face, and Tonki goes silent at once.
I would rather understand nothing about this place, Yika says, brutally quiet and cold now, than risk destroying it. Can you say the same?
Tonki stares back at her, trembling visibly and saying nothing. But the answer's obvious, isn't it? Tonki's like Kjarka. Both were raised leadership, raised to put the needs of others first, and both chose a more selfish path. It's not even a question. Which is why later, in retrospect, you really aren't surprised at what happens next. Tonki turns and lunges, and the red warning flashes, and then one of the iron bits is in her fist. She's already turning away by the time you register her grab, bolting for the stair door. Kjarka gasps. Yika's just standing there, a little startled and mostly resigned. The two strongbacks stare in confusion and then belatedly start after Tonki. But then an instant later, Tonki gasps and stumbles to a halt. One of the strongbacks grabs her arm but drops it immediately when Tonki yells. You're moving before you think. Tonki is yours somehow. Like Hoa, like Lerna, like Alabaster. As if, in the absence of your children, you're trying to adopt everybody who touches you emotionally for even an instant. You don't even like Tonki. Still, your belly clenches when you grab her wrist and see that blood streaks her hand. What the? Tonki looks at you. Quick, animal panic. Then she jerks and cries out again. And you almost let go this time because... something moves under your thumb. The rust? Yika blurts. Yarka's hand clasps over Tonki's arm too, helping, because Tonki's strong in her panic. You master your inexplicable violent revulsion enough to instead move your thumb and hold Tonki's wrist so that you can get a good look at it. Yes, there's something moving just under her skin. It jumps and jitters, but moves inexorably upward, following the path of a large vein there. It's just large enough to be the iron fragment.
Evil earth, Kjarka says, throwing a quick, worried look at Tonki's face. You fight sudden hysterical laughter at the unintentional irony of Kjarka's oath. I need a knife,
you say instead. Your voice sounds remarkably calm to your own ears. Yika leans over, sees what you've seen, and breathes an oath.
Oh, fuck, Rust, shit, Tonki moans. Get it out, and I'll never come in here again.
It's a lie, but maybe she means it for the moment.
I can bite it out.
Hyarka looks up at you. Her sharpened teeth are small razors.
No,
you say, certain it would just go into Hyarka and do the same thing. Tongues were harder to carve than arms.
Yika barks, knife,
at the strongbacks, the one with the wireglass knife. It's sharp but small, meant more for cutting rope than as a weapon. Unless you hit a vital area right off, you'd have to stab someone a million times to kill them with it. It's all you've got. You keep hold of Tonki's wrist because she's flailing and growling like an animal. Someone puts the knife in your hand, fumbling, and blade first. It feels like it takes a year to get it repositioned, but you keep your gaze on that jerking, moving lump in Tonki's brown flesh. Where the rust is it going? You're too quietly horrified to speculate. But before you can put the knife in place to carve the moving thing loose, it vanishes. Tonki screams again, her voice breaking and horrible. It's gone into the meat of her. You slash once, opening a deep cut just above the elbow, which should be ahead of the thing. Tonki groans.
Deeper! I can feel it!
Deeper and you'll hit bone. But you set your teeth and cut deeper. There's blood everywhere. Ignoring Tonki's pants and hisses, you try to probe for the thing. Even though privately you're terrified you'll find it and it'll go into your flesh next.
Arterial!
Tonki pants. She's shaking, keening through her teeth between every word.
Like a rusting high road to... Sessa! Fuck!
She claps at the lower half of her bicep. It's farther up her arm than you expected. Moving faster now that it's reached the larger arteries.
Sessa?
You stare at Tonki for a moment, chilled by the realization that she was trying to say Sessapine. Yika reaches over you and wraps a hand around Tonki's arm, just below the deltoid, squeezing tight. She looks at you, but you know there's only one thing left to do. You're not going to be able to manage it with the tiny knife. But there are other weapons. Hold her arm out. Without waiting to see whether Yika and Hyarka comply, you grip Tonki's shoulder. It's Alabaster's trick that you're thinking of. A tiny, fine-spun, localized torus, like the ones he used to kill the boil bugs. This time you'll use it to burrow through Tonki's arm and freeze the little iron shard, hopefully. But as you extend your awareness and shut your eyes to concentrate, something shifts. You're deep in the heat of her, seeking the metallic lattice of the iron shard and trying to assess the difference between its structure and that of the iron in her blood, and then, yes, the silver glimmer of magic is there. You weren't expecting that, here amid the gelid bauble of her cells. Tonki isn't turning into stone like Alabaster, and you've never sensed magic in any other living creature. Yet, here in Tonki, there is something that gleams steadily, silverish and thread-like, coming up through her feet from where? Doesn't matter, and ending at the iron shard. No wonder the thing can move so quickly, fueled as it is by something else. Using this power source, it stretches forth tendrils of its own to link into Tonki's flesh and drag itself along. This is why it hurts her. Because every cell it touches shivers as if burned and then dies. The tendrils get longer with every contact, too. The fucking thing is growing its way through her, feeding on her in some imperceptible way. A lead tendril feels its way along, orienting always toward Tonki's Sessapine, and you know instinctively that letting it get there will be bad. You try grabbing onto the root thread, thinking maybe to stall it or starve it of strength, but oh, no. There is hate and We all do what we have to do. There is anger and... Ah, hello, little enemy.
Hey! Yarka's voice in your ear, a shout. Wake the fuck up!
You jerk out of the fog you weren't aware of drifting into. Okay. You stay away from the root tendril lest you get another taste of whatever is driving the thing. That instant of contact was worth it, though, because now you know what to do. You visualize scissors with edges of infinite fineness and blades of glimmering silver. Cut the lead. Cut the tendrils, or they may grow again. Cut the contamination before it can set hooks any deeper in her. You're thinking of Tonki as you do this, wanting to save her life. But Tonki is not Tonki to you right now. She is a collection of particles and substances. You make the cut. This isn't your fault. I know you won't ever believe it, but it isn't. And when you manage to relax your sesapine and adjust your perception back to the macro scale, and you find yourself covered, absolutely covered in blood, you're surprised. You don't quite understand why Tonki is on the floor, gasping. Her body is surrounded by a spreading pool as Hjarka shouts at one of the strongbacks to hand her his belt. Now! Now! You feel the jerk of the iron shard nearby and twitch in alarm because you know now what those things are trying to do. And that they are evil. But when you turn to look at the iron shard, you're confused, because all you see is smooth bronze skin streaked with blood and a scrap of familiar cloth. Then there is a sort of twitchy movement, weight making itself known in your hand, and, well, you're holding Tonki's severed arm. You drop it, fling it, more like, violent in your shock. It bounces just beyond Yika and the two strongbacks who are clustering around Tonki and doing something, maybe trying to save her life. You can't even wrap your head around that, because now you see that the cut end of Tonki's arm is a perfect, slightly slanted cross-section, still bleeding and twitching because you just cut it off. But wait, no, that is not the only reason. From a small hole near the bone, you see something wriggle forth. The hole is the cross-section of an artery. The something is the iron shard, which drops to the smooth green floor, and then lies amid the splattered blood, as if it is nothing more than a harmless bit of metal. Hello, little enemy. Interlude. There is a thing you will not see happening, yet that is going to impact the rest of your life. Imagine it. Imagine me. You know what I am, you think, both with your thinking mind and the animal instinctive part of you. You see a stone body clothed in flesh, and even though you never really believed I was human, you did think of me as a child. You still think it, though Alabaster has told you the truth, that I haven't been a child since before your language existed. Perhaps I was never a child. Hearing this and believing it are two different things, however. You should imagine me as what I truly am among my kind, then. Old and powerful, and greatly feared. A legend? A monster. You should imagine Kastrima as an egg. Moats around this egg, lurking in the stone. Eggs are a rich prize for scavengers, and easy to devour if left unguarded. This one is being devoured, though the people of Kastrima are barely aware of the act. Yika alone, I think, and even she only suspects. Such a leisurely repast isn't a thing most of your kind would notice. We are a very slow people. It will be deadly nevertheless, once the devouring is done. Yet something has made the scavengers pause, teeth bared but not sinking in. There is another old and powerful one here, the one you call Antimony. She isn't interested in guarding the egg, but she could if she chose. She will
if they attempt to poach her alabaster. The others are aware of this, and wary of her. They shouldn't be. I'm the one they should fear. I destroy three of them on the first day after I leave you. As you stand, sharing a mellow with Yika, I tear apart Yika's stone-eater, the red-haired creature that she's been calling Luster and you've been calling Ruby-hair. Filthy parasite, lurking only to take and give nothing back. I despise her. We are meant for better. Then I take the two who have been stalking Alabaster, hoping to dart in, should Antimony become distracted. This is not because Antimony needs the help, mind, but simply because our race cannot bear that level of stupidity. I cull them for the good of us all. They're not really dead if that troubles you. We cannot die. In 10,000 years or 10 million, they will reconstitute themselves from the component atoms into which I've scattered them. A long time in which to contemplate their folly, and do better next time. This initial slaughter makes many of the others flee. Scavengers are cowards at heart. They don't go far, though. Of those who remain near, a few attempt parley. Plenty for us all, they say, if even one has the potential. But I catch some of these watching you and not Alabaster. They confess to me as I circle them and pretend that I might be merciful. They speak of another old one who is known to me from conflicts long ago. He too has a vision for our kind, in opposition to mine. He knows of you, my Esun, and he would kill you if he could, because you mean to finish what Alabaster began. He can't get to you with me in the way, but he can push you to destroy yourself. He's even found some greedy human allies up north to help him do so. Ugh, this ridiculous war of ours. We use your kind so easily. Even you, my Esun, my treasure, my pawn. One day, I hope you will forgive me.